Hello, and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks and the Learning College. I'm Alex Linder, and you can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com and also at alexlinder.com when it's completely archived. Today we're going to do part of Chapter 9 from James Mason's Siege. Chapter 9 is called Universal Order. We're going to do 9.1 to 9.15, about 20 pages. It begins with some epigraphs. First, from Vidkun Quisling, the man whose name has been associated in popular media, the Jew-controlled media, with treason, something he said in 1945. Do not handicap yourselves with the idea of revenge, because the trend of events will avenge the wrongs that you suffer, not only in the case of the individuals who initiated the persecutions, but also of the society that has permitted this lawlessness. Vidkun Quisling, 1945, that was. Next, to get yourself together, you need not to even think there is anyone else in the world. I don't need to look down on or get off on or get over on. The hardest thing to overcome is our own lies, confusion, and our jealousy. And that's Charles Manson. And again, from the same, open up the dope valves and let the people take all the dope they want. Let them dope themselves on out till there's nothing left of it. Let the people do what they want to do. Take the rules and regulations off of it, and then what you have left is the people that want to live. The people that want to die, let them go. The people that want to destroy themselves, let them go ahead and destroy themselves. Charles Manson, 1984. 9.1, Night of the Buck Knives, as opposed to Night of the Long Knives. If any single historic similarity links Hitler to Manson in the eyes of friends and foe alike, surely it has to be what have become known as the Tate Killings of 1969. One cannot bring up the name of Charles Manson for discussion without having these killings brought into the picture by the moralists and curiosity seekers, just as one cannot bring up the name of Hitler without some conditioned brainwashees harping away on the 6 million. I now undertake, to the best of my knowledge, for the first time, the task of analyzing these killings strictly from the pro viewpoint, and hope to come out with arguments superior to those of the anti-camp. I do this with no first-hand knowledge of the events, and certainly without the sanction of either Manson or any of his associates. One thing I do, however, bring into the balance with my study of this most fascinating chapter in recent American history is a broad background as a National Socialist and the understanding of the modus operandi of the Jews and their controlled media. I bring with me also a background as a National Socialist revolutionary and all of the anti-establishment modes of thought and action which that involves. Finally, I am supported by a better-than-average knowledge of, and familiarity with, some of the principles in the case. What follows, then, would have to be viewed as the appraisal of the Tate killings by a sympathetic white revolutionary. Tate killings of 1969. First of all, it is necessary to dispel the prevailing mythology surrounding the case in precisely the same way as an entire universe of corresponding legend has to be done away with that was erected around the matter of European Jews during the Second World War. Manson, too, had his equivalents of Speer, Frank, Eichmann, who, seeing that the jig was up, exulted in commanding huge fanfare for themselves, yet were artists when it came to shifting the real blame. A very large proportion of the most bizarre blood and gore and, I might add, perverse stories connected with the case were the inventions of Susan Atkins as she struggled to do her best to impress the grand jury after she had been indicted in the course of the investigation of another case. The opportunistic prosecuting attorney, Vincent Bugliosi, merely made capital of it in his subsequent book, Helter Skelter, and a legend was born. It mattered not that Susan Atkins later retracted her statements. Enough evidence had been gleaned by the system to go on to crack the case, and the media had the suitable grist for its myth mill. That's the end of that section, and its provenance is unknown. 9.2. It couldn't have happened to a nicer bunch. Let us now go on to get rid of another clumsy but commonly held misconception, that of the poor innocent victims. Those of you with backgrounds similar to mine in the American National Socialist movement will be among the first to sadly admit that it was indeed a damnable shame that Hitler did not, in fact, kill at least 6 million Jews during the war. We are the minority who know what the Jews were and are all about, and we can shed no tears for any of them. The rest of the gullible public sees things otherwise. So we have before us the image of the beautiful actress, Sharon Tate, 8 months pregnant, slaughtered in her home with a number of her equally beautiful friends, by a bunch of crazed beasts out for a blood glut, per se. Sound familiar in premise? Sort of like all those beautiful, talented, and peace-loving Jews that a certain madman bent on conquering the world took an irrational dislike to. How knowledgeable are most of you about the Tate case, even if that means judging it based upon the hostile and distorted versions available in bookstores? An intelligent, informed person can still learn much truth even from the worst liars if he knows what to look for. I found that the house on Cielo Drive, Cielo, like Spanish word for heavens, I think, in L.A., scene of the killing, I found that the house on Cielo Drive in L.A., scene of the killings, had been occupied by one Terry Melcher, half-Jewish son of white renegade actress Doris Day, and that Melcher had made the acquaintance of Manson as a music promoter and had reneged on a series of promises he had made Manson over the previous year or more. In fact, it appears as though Manson and some associates had been at the house as guests on a few occasions. This much, then, rules out the false notion of random killings. It may have been an accident that the house on Cielo Drive had been since taken by Roman Polanski, Jewish film director and erstwhile child molester, at the time of the killings, but it is irrelevant when one stops to consider that the strata of human type stayed steady throughout the transition of tenants. Given that, then, it is helpful to take a look at what is known of the people who were in that house on the night of the killings. My sources are the very books that were written to, first of all, make money off the sensationalism, and secondly, to defame Manson and his associates for having been anti-establishment enough to have dared to lay hands on the beautiful people. They are the following: Helter Skelter by Bugliosi and Gentry, The Family by Ed Sanders, Will You Die for Me by Charles Watson, Child of Satan, Child of God by Susan Atkins, and The Manson Women by Clara Livesey, Livsey. End of that section, also provenance unknown. 9.3. Hollywood Rogues Gallery. Sharon Tate, whose most famous role was in Valley of the Dolls, wherein she had typified the supreme harlot role for a nation of impressionable young white girls to emulate, had as her first business agent one Hal Gefsky, G-E-F-S-K-Y. Her early producer, as well as her lover, had been one Martin Ransohoff, R-E-N-S-O-H-O-F-F. Still another lover of that period, Jay Sebring, a.k.a. Coomer, was to be among the dead at Cielo Drive a few years hence. Tate had come to meet Roman Polanski when her producer-lover, Ransohoff, had hired Polanski to direct one of his films. Though Polanski came Wojtek Frykowski, who had known Polanski from the old days in Poland, and who was to become yet another Cielo Drive death. Polanski and Tate began their affair, and he wasted no time in exploiting her Aryan looks by getting her into a nude spread in Playboy magazine during 1967. They were married in 1968. The Polanskis were such close friends of the likes of Robert Kennedy that they were present the night of his killing. That would be in 1968. From the beginning, it was known and accepted that the Polanskis were regular users of LSD. A glance at the rest of those present at Cielo Drive that night reveals that Wojtek Frykowski, V-O-I-T-Y-C-K-F-R-Y-K-O-W-S-K-I, Wojtek Frykowski had been dealing in a substance known as methylene dioxylamphetamine, which is used as a stimulant as well as an aphrodisiac. It was revealed that Frykowski was, quote, on this substance himself at the time of his death. He was also involved in a marijuana smuggling ring, which brought that substance into the U.S. from Jamaica via Canada. Through Frykowski came Abigail Folger, his lover and member in good standing of the Filthy Rich set as Folger Coffee heiress. The nominally white Miss Folger had just campaigned for Negro Tom Bradley for mayor of L.A. and had been a volunteer social worker in Watts. Jay Sebring was a successful men's hairstylist who took his business name from the once famous racetrack, or from the famous racetrack. After his death, it was revealed by the LAPD that Sebring had been heavy into sadomasochism after they had discovered whips, chains, studded cuffs, hoods, and even films of these activities on Sebring's premises. The teenager, Stephen Parent, it would appear, did have the dubious distinction of having been at the wrong place at entirely the right time, or the wrong time. Some of those who, as easily as not, might have been at that place that night at Cielo Drive included Terry Melcher himself, Roger Vadim, one-time husband of Jane Fonda, who had just celebrated a birthday at the house, Jerzy Kosinski, matchmaker for Frykowski and Folger. I think he was the Jewish writer who made up Holocaust tales. The Painted Bird is a book I remember that was around a lot during that time. Had actually been supposed to be there, Jerzy Kosinski. And finally, Roman Polanski himself, who happened to be off tending to another film. After the killings, the LAPD found at the house large quantities of cocaine and mescaline, as well as videotapes depicting scenes of sadism, masochism, and bestiality. The boy, Stephen Parent, had not been at the house at all, but was about to depart the grounds after visiting at the servants' quarters. This leaves only Tate, Sebring, Frykowski, and Folger. Much speculation has been made concerning Sebring's presence there in Polanski's absence. The nature of the relationship between Folger and Frykowski is clear. With regard to the 8-month-old fetus Tate was carrying, it was, after all, a Jew. Provenance of that section is also unknown. Nine. 4. Foreword and afterword. Just as one can't get a clear picture of the so-called Holocaust by glimpsing a picture of a pile of bodies, one can't understand the happenings of that night in summer 1969 by looking at the events of one night. Fewer people know of the Gary Hinman and Donald Shea killings than of the Tate killings, but they form part of the picture equally as important as the rest. Gary Hinman had been a student at UCLA with a PhD in sociology. Those, again, with a National Socialist background recall what Commander Rockwell wrote about sociology. Hinman was also a convert to a thing called Nichiren Shoshu Buddhism, and was also engaged at home in the manufacturing of synthetic mescaline. Hinman was also a homosexual. He had made the acquaintance of Manson and some of his associates, and his home was known as a hideout for various dropouts and drug users. The stories were that Hinman had been responsible for drug, quote, burns in the selling of bad drugs, and that he had made the habit of making passes at male members of Manson's group. Hinman turned up dead, and a number of Manson's people were arrested as suspects in his killing in July of 1969. The theory has already been put forth that the Tate killings were originally designed to take heat away from those of Manson's people already being held by making it appear that the real killers were still at large. Quote, "political piggy," unquote, was found written at Hinman's place, and, quote, "helter skelter," unquote, was found at Cielo Drive. The choice of who and where to strike would have been obvious, and would have been a matter of killing two birds with one stone, as it were. Donald Shorty Shea had been a Hollywood stuntman, as well as a ranch hand at the Spahn Ranch, where Manson and his group called home part of the time. George Spahn had recently sold the ranch, and the new owners, with the law or otherwise, enlisted Shea's help as a pimp to try and involve Manson with the law or otherwise aid in his removal from the ranch. Shea also happened to be married to a black chorus girl. Shea, too, was reportedly killed, though his body was never found. The deaths of the LaBiancas, which followed immediately after those of Tate and Company, were most likely intended as more of the same smokescreen tactic aimed at police investigation. That section 9.4 is also unknown in provenance. 9.5. Would you if you could? As a National Socialist, says Mason, I am not interested in sensationalism. Instead of gruesome details, I want to know the why and wherefore of things. As with the facts disproving Nazi gas chambers, plus information on why Jews were concentrated, similar circumstances surrounding the Tate killings are tacitly suppressed. We are satisfied the right people got it in both cases, and if there is fault to be found, it is that the Second World War was lost, and that Manson and some of his best people were apprehended and jailed. Call it revolution, helter-skelter, or whatever you want, it is war between life and death forces, and war means killing. The key, as Commander Rockwell said, is that it still remains a one-sided war, with the only blows landed being those of the enemy. You read of it each day. We, the whites, are fair game, whether it be our minds, our souls, our spirits, our culture, our country, or our very blood that is being attacked and destroyed. To the media, that is only par for the course. But let our side make an attack, and you know the results. If you could mount a successful attack yourself, would you do it? Would you condone it by others? Do you really know who your enemies are? Do you know what is happening and what is at stake? If there is ever to come a genuine movement, then it will only come about through people who have gotten their thinking straight, for without the right thought, nothing of any value can hope to follow. The killings of July and August 1969 were prime examples of direct action, and in cases of revolution or national liberation, direct action alone merits the highest respect. Those out front, putting themselves on the line and taking the action, as Tomasi wrote, are in fact the real leaders and are at the top level of the struggle. All else pales to insignificance, as events over the past 13 years would tend to prove. Everything combined that has been attempted on the part of this movement since the death of Commander Rockwell in 1967 stands at zero when compared to the magnitude of and vibrations from that one night in August 1969 that have continued ever since. Neither I nor anyone else has the right to question or judge what happened in 1969, least of all from a moralistic standpoint. It is only that we have misread it for so long. The historic march of events never stops at the death of a single individual. However, poor mortals can and do often get out of step with or fail to recognize that same historic march when it reconstitutes itself into another form. We have been 13 years in the wilderness. I do know that with the death of Hitler and the loss of the Second World War, the situation was transformed to the point where something very much like helter-skelter most probably already is and shall more and more become the order of the day. I pose the merit of the notion of a series of similar actions by members of the movement, directly on the heels of the arrest of Joseph Paul Franklin, in order to have some heat taken away from Franklin, and to, as Tomasi would say, heighten the contradictions. That section also unknown in origin. Nine point six, nearer the truth. Or how I broke the right-wing habit and started living life. The fact remains that the truth is one, and the conflict only enters because, due to racial differences in the world, the truth smiles more on some than on others. The right wing is a history of deviations, off-channels, and side rails from the main line of truth, concocted mainly by those who didn't have it in them to stand in the harsh, naked glare of unadorned truth. National Socialism has been the closest thing yet to approach successfully the task of putting the truth to work in reality. But this was done very far away and nearly 40 years ago. The practice of mixing truth with lies in an effort to formulate something that the sick masses might accept without much struggle has resulted in the right having built for itself an insurmountable obstacle of self-imposed hang-ups and restrictions. 99% of everything in the right goes toward maintaining the facade of this or that particular illusion, whether it be turning the clock back to 1876, 1933, or whatever. The National Socialist Liberation Front, from the time I had reactivated it in 1980 and up until the present, has slowly and steadily been gaining acceptance among the members of the movement, having long ago grown sorely disappointed with the totally out-of-touch, cultist, hobbyist, fetishist Nazi organizations that had held the stage heretofore. In NSLF, at least, they found reality and honesty. But after 2 years of following this course, it had already become clear to me that the key element was still lacking, and we were still a long way from starting the kind of movement that will catch on, take hold, and spread in the manner of all historically significant and successful movements. About 1 month after I had put out the first issue of the new Siege in the summer of 1980, I made my first contact with the Charles Manson people. In the 2 years that followed, that relationship grew to where now it has become too large to remain confined and camouflaged inside the idea of a fallen comrade, Joseph Tomasi, whose work I had earlier set myself to keeping alive, as it was the best thing I had run across up to that time. No recorded comment of Tomasi's on Manson is known to exist, even though Tomasi was in high gear operation in the L.A. area at the time of the Tate killings. He, precisely as I at the time, probably missed the greater point to the thing entirely. I would venture to guess, however, that he would not take kindly to anyone trying to mix, quote, apples and oranges with regards to the NSLF and Manson. And as far as Manson is concerned, I was advised over a year ago to forget what I was doing in NSLF and start over fresh. As I feel I must pursue this course unencumbered by considerations of the past, the decision was made to leave NSLF and start Universal Order, a name suggested to me by the highest authority, Manson himself. That is what I have now done, so that's the origin of his Universal Order. Provenance of that section also unknown. 9.7, Universal Order. In the fabulous book, The Turner Diaries, mention is made of the book, which revolutionized the organization from some pitiful thing, such as we see today, into that which did indeed go on to smash the system and erect a white state, not only in North America, but in the entire world. Even according to Turner Diaries calculations, the book has yet to be written. So it is with Universal Order. Nothing is written. I am handicapped by this in that all I can do for the present is offer my impressions and observations and wait for the day when a complete revelation is offered. I am aware that things of this nature are in the works at present, though I'd be foolish to try to place any timetable on their appearance. If I were to be asked what Universal Order is, I'd have to respond in language and terms as familiar and easily understood as possible, even though they may not be entirely fitting. For those among my former affiliates, I would say without reservation that it is everything National Socialism is, and much, much more. It is geared to the present conditions. It is as dynamic as, maybe more so, the National Socialism, because its true leader is alive, a contemporary of all of us. It is uniquely American, and it is now. It has no links whatsoever with conservatism or the right wing, or the left for that matter. It largely disarms the enemy because he doesn't know what to expect of it or how to deal with it. It has a fascination and appeal to youth. Volume 11, Number 11, November 1982. 9.8. Living It. One essence in the comparison of Manson versus right-wingism is that right-wing groups, as well as individuals, dream it and play at it, simultaneously working their system jobs and living their establishment lives, while Manson and those who follow his idea live it by dropping out of the system and by attacking the system. Truly, the same could be said of the conventional left wing as well. To attach the necessary political connotation to it, rather than Mansonism, one would have to say universal order in reference to this new mode of living. The key is the total dropping out and away from the system. That, in itself, constitutes one of the greatest forms of attack. Carried to its conclusion, it would affect a moribund system, caught alone, isolated in a mass of very angry people, eventually at their complete mercy. Passive resistance a la Gandhi only set in America? Perhaps. It has its comparisons. The movement is struggling closer to individually waged guerrilla warfare on the system, but it is a long way from tackling the system's pigs as an opposing army. Yet we must act now in some manner of an effective yet wisely prudent, appropriate way. And that was unknown as well. 9.9. Universal Order versus the Left-Right Spectrum. Even as Commander Rockwell was saying 20 years ago, classic notions of left and right were becoming then, and certainly are by now, obsolete and meaningless. To place this into perspective, by referring to left and right, one only expands the context of, while remaining on the same plane as, those extremely foolish ones who still think in terms of party politics. Democrat versus Republican, liberal versus conservative, the point being that these terms are all equally system terms, because in reality, at the core of their set programs, they each support the system and are a part of it. What has been missing up till now has been a clean dividing line, an actual breaking point, where all pretenses of working within the system, by its rules, were dropped once and for all. In short, a complete break with time past. As has been said earlier in Siege, those who control the system, by having ultimately succeeded in effecting total control over every official, recognized aspect of society, business, government, media, etc., have lost control over the course of events through having done away with competent, legitimate opposition that could conceivably step in and take over in an orderly manner, as Hitler's NSDAP did in 1933. An incredibly dangerous, explosive situation this is, for it's becoming clearer each day that those in control and their minions are losing the ability to hold the pieces together. Yet there is no relief, there are no answers forthcoming from any reputable direction. This, of course, spells total collapse, total anarchy, total destruction. And it shall mean that any babbling about conservative, a little less of this, or liberal, a little more of that, will one day be rewarded with a bullet. When the mess collapses, the obvious will become clear. There is only one correct way of handling elemental human problems, not by further compromise, but through universal order. Rather than viewing the world and its affairs from an artificially created vantage point of any outmoded political philosophy, it will be a matter of dealing directly with reality from any point where one finds oneself at that moment. Universal order means reality applied to now, capital letters. And that was Volume 11, Number 12, December 1982. 9.10, 9.10, dichotomy. Scrupulous honesty is what universal order is all about. Charles Manson, who provides most of our current-day inspiration, refers to himself as a servant in the truth. Yet in the day-to-day course of revolution and propaganda, the necessary use of the lie and the half-truth are repeatedly and often called into active play. Many times in order to preserve life and liberty. If we deceive successfully the system and its pigs, what is lost? Nothing. If, on the other hand, we play as good citizens with respect to the laws and the powers that be and succeed in deceiving ourselves at the same time, what then is lost? Everything. As George Lincoln Rockwell said, "In this current struggle for the survival and safety of the white race, only failure is immoral." We accept that statement literally at its face and see nothing reprehensible in the lie as a means to an end, and nothing whatsoever. Indeed, it is but one of the weapons in our arsenal against the Big Brother system, whose policy has as its very end the lie. That section was unknown. 9.11. Whole people. Another of the differences between the outlook and strategy of universal order and the rest of the entire strata of various political groups, one that is so basic it is mainly overlooked or misunderstood, is that universal order does not seek to indoctrinate people or make people over, it seeks to free them. While the rest of the political groups, both left and right, attempt to inject their own brand of dogma over top of the establishment distortions, universal order would erase those primary distortions and let the person be himself. Political dogmas can be cracked and undone by various methods or just by circumstances alone. One may even grow tired of them after a time. But once a person has been released from the alien and false, unnatural conditioning from birth by a commercial, materialistic, and regressive establishment, then that can never be undone. It might even be called brainwashing, as opposed to the system's brain dirtying. We do not want system establishment people with any kind of veneer of conservative, liberal, left, right, who are playing a part in a movie of their own. We want whole people, real people who can see, think, and act independently, free of any artificial phony input which must be, by definition, a concoction by, of, and for the past. And these are the only kind of people that can ever make a true movement. That's unknown as well in origin. 9.12, 9.12, family. I do not use the term in the sense that the right wing and the reactionaries use it when they moan about the system's assault on the family and how the American family has been atomized and effectively destroyed. This is all quite true enough, but it has little bearing on what's to be done with regard to the success of the future. Manson had the right idea about family. It involved people of the same race, the same spirit, coming together for mutual security. Most may have turned their backs on their real families in order to have found the one true family, but such is the case with regard to a struggle such as this one with overtones of civil warfare. Hand in hand with revolution, with survival, is the elemental component of the family. It is really the only way the system can be destroyed, really the only way we can survive. Tribes of white warriors, bands of white men with their women and children who have drawn together and then pulled away from the system to allow it to fall without taking them with it. The only insurance we've got against being picked off one by one, being atomized and casually victimized by the system's pigs, is to stick together. Go and get even those most hostile accounts of the Charles Manson family's days in California's Death Valley, and you'll see how it was done. It must be done again in hundreds of thousands of locations across the country. Again, the movement has added its own words of direction on how these family-type units must be arranged to assure at least a minimum chance of success and survival. It's not to be done for fun or caprice, but for life or death. Volume 12, Number 1, January 1983. 9.13, a combination impossible 10 years ago. Those who have read thus far in Siege will know what I have put forth regarding myself, being a former member of the American Nazi Party, and the Charles Manson family, and, I would hope, by now begin to understand the why and the how of it. For the rest, the revelations of such things may come as quite a shock, you can be sure. It could almost pass as, quote, shock for shock's sake alone. The two most defamed, sensationalized groups in contemporary America, now linked together not just by a few in the movement, but by the system press as well. Needless to say, it couldn't have happened much before now. The Manson people look upon and accept the NS movement in America with curiosity, some admiration, and some dismay. Hate, they say, is not going to get it. Direct quote. Trying to live in another time and place isn't going to get it either. To our charges of a monstrous Jewish conspiracy, they simply counter with a stated belief that people today have a death wish for themselves. We say that without unpolluted white blood, there will be no civilization left. They say that without an unpolluted world, there can be no white race, or any other race for that matter. Most importantly, though, they show understanding and are willing to have a dialogue. The same cannot be said for the majority in the movement. A nasty commentary when it becomes clear that media brainwash has not affected their view of us, but has, on the other hand, for the most part, affected almost totally our view of them. For me, for all those who are in the least bit perceptive, this fact is most revealing. No one condemned bigotry, prejudice, and knee-jerk snap reactions more roundly than did Commander Rockwell. It comes down to reinforced blindness and ignorance, redneckism. Manson says that the truth is one. The movement, for the most, obviously places the codes of dying, decaying, Jewish subverted tradition and morals first, ahead of truth or reality. An even nastier commentary, because it has always been so, and that remains one more prime reason for the failure of the movement. And now, lo and behold, we see that the arch reactionaries of the movement can no longer ignore the mile-high writing on the wall, and have admitted that theirs is no party at all, have indicated that no such party is any longer possible or even desirable under present conditions, and have announced the founding of an, quote, order of their own, approximately 90 days after the appearance of universal order. An admission that the old phony pretenses of a party not only hadn't been producing any results in many years, but that the cultist remains from the mid-70s were in immediate danger of evaporating into thin air. Hence, a new name and a dropping of some false pretenses. Reality does have a way, after having been ignored and put off long enough, of making its presence felt much like a sledgehammer right between the eyes. You can also get a stubborn donkey to move by building a fire under him. How many steps that donkey will take away from that fire, or in which direction, is an uncertainty. But such a dramatic, if long-delayed reaction, should be proof positive of the changing times. Blue skying for fun and profit has been rendered practically extinct by ever harsher realities that no one can ignore or escape. I regard all this merely as a confirmation, not as anything too encouraging, as I do still expect to see the same old sales pitch as before for some variation of Spanky and our gang ideals and mentality. Regulations for how you have your hair cut will most likely persist, even while Manson continues to speak in terms of life versus death. For the rest of you, those who, as long ago as I, dropped out of the more overt brand of nonsense, I urge again to look beyond the media-created images to the truth of the matter, and you'll see how those differences which may exist between the movement and the Manson idea are minor. How survival is everything. Volume 12, Number 2, February 1983, that was. 9:14, toward the unity of whites. I was particularly struck by one glaring omission made by the communist press in their reports of the mass actions lately in demonstration against KKK and Nazi presence in Oroville, California. They did not repeat one of the main themes still to be found in the Big Brother press, to wit, the involvement of Charles Manson's influence within the Oroville Nazi faction. Almost incredibly, and certainly too stark and obvious to be lightly dismissed. Do they wish to hide the fact of Manson's involvement? Do they fear to attack Manson in their publications, to their respective memberships, and the public at large? That the communists are far more realistic, pragmatic, and perceptive in their understanding of and dealings with people than the movement has ever been can hardly be denied when one takes a look at the numbers they can throw onto the streets at almost a moment's notice. Commander Rockwell stressed at one point, with regard to communist strategy in the United States, the fact that they must somehow bring about the large-scale working union of black and white workers or else admit failure. While they have come a lot closer to that goal than the right ever did toward its goal of a large-scale working union of whites from all social strata to the exclusion of coloreds, in terms of national power, they fall critically short. And what success they have had in that regard, and to whatever degree that is genuine and authentic, has, quote, blessed their ranks with the absolute scum of the earth. How about those basically good whites who find themselves amongst that group out of want of any place better to be, who have no great love for Jews or blacks, but hate the system too much to do nothing? It could easily be said that unless all radicalized, revolutionized whites can be united, then the dream of Commander Rockwell can never be fulfilled. The effective realization of that dream was also an impossibility during the 1960s and on into the 1970s, at which time the whites were too badly polarized over trivial, superficial matters, again concocted by Jews for the purpose of divisiveness. Issues like the morality of Vietnam, segregation versus integration, the generation gap, Watergate, etc. Manson at the time was outspoken about getting out of Vietnam. Commander Rockwell was on record saying that he believed that segregation was wrong and would not work. The biggest difference was in how various people and groups reacted to these irritations and outrages thrust into the life of the country by agitating Jews. I don't know if he meant segregation or integration, but it says segregation. The truth of the matter, and even the so-called issues themselves, were lost in the heave and sway of reactions. Meanwhile, the plan of the protocols marched onward, practically unnoticed. But today, most of the worst of the Big Brother subterfuge that played on the emotions of idealistic yet duped whites has been replaced by realities too ugly to ignore, and which are fast driving these people into the same boat. Leftists could generally admire everything about Manson except his views on race, the most crucial thing of all. Sadly and ironically, the right allows the lesser peripheral items to overshadow, in their eyes, Manson's racial and family social philosophy. But then there are those hypocritical racist Reds and those non-conservative, truly revolutionary beefsteak Nazis, brown on the outside, red on the inside, who are instinctively true to the genuine fight, who could and might repeat the mass phenomenon which occurred in Germany when white men in droves abandoned the fraudulent Jewish communist revolution and became part of the army of the swastika, which incidentally Manson has retained, except in a manner that revolves to the left. The prospect is too much for the enemy to contemplate. Volume 12, Number 2, February 1983. Finally, the last section we're going to do in this segment. 9:15, Youth-Oriented. Those in the struggle never tire of exclaiming how there is no time left, or at least not much time left, before it becomes too late. What's more, they've been saying it for 30 years. True, it is too late for certain things to be attempted. In fact, it is true that with each passing year, more and more options are removed. But too late is something that cannot be applied in a general sense. A hell of a lot can happen in a mighty short time if only the right moves are made. The hurry, therefore, doesn't have nearly so much to do with the situation as it does with the fact that those of us looking at the thing clearly want to stop wasting our time and get on with something that's going to prove worthwhile, that will gain results. And youth is the name to be applied to the group of people among whom you will find a majority of those who demand results, not right-wing bullshit. Manson explains that the older a person becomes, the more frozen they are in the program ways the system is inculcated in them. Not only that, usually the older a person becomes, the more conservative they become in their whole attitude and outlook. Certainly true. It's more of a personal thing than a political thing. Nowadays, and for quite a while now, people have begun to march to the grave very, very early. The death wish the system implants, practically at birth, just grows and grows with the passage of time. The most adept social and political movers of all times have known that, in order to have a successful movement, you must get them while they are young. It is quite true, and especially so to those with rightist backgrounds, that youth today is in a mess. Can they be blamed? Their cowardly, hypocritical elders, on the one hand, having abandoned them over to the care of Big Brother, who has done probably the most monumental mass brainwash of any time on them, by first omitting and eliminating or ridiculing anything of worth in their heritage, and then second by telling them they're as good as niggers and by filling the vacuum already created with their own brand of insanity. However, as thoroughgoing as the job the Jews have done, is, people are still looking. They're still hungry for something that rings true and worthwhile. It is youth that has the most to lose, that has traditionally been the most idealistic and action-minded. Charles Manson exerts a fascination over youth today in the entire West, more so by far than anyone else even remotely attuned to what we're trying to do. That was Volume 12, Number 2, February 1983. So this was the first of three segments that we're going to do for Chapter 9. So thanks for being with me today, and I'll be back with you again real soon, and we'll pick up with Chapter 9.